Hello, and welcome to A Good Science Read, where we discuss science books written for the general public. I'm Professor Frances Ashcroft, and my guest today is Matthew Freeman, Professor of Pathology at the University of Oxford, and a Fellow of both Lincoln College, Oxford, and the Royal Society of London. Matthew's research focuses on how cells communicate with one another, and what happens when this communication goes wrong. In diseases such as cancer, infectious disease, and inflammatory disorders. He's also head of the Dunn School of Pathology in Oxford, which plays a very special part in the book we are discussing today. And this is The Mould in Dr. Florey's Coat by Eric Lax. As its subtitle states, it tells the true story of the penicillin miracle, penicillin being the mould in Dr. Florey's coat. When most people are asked who discovered penicillin, they invariably answer Alexander Fleming. But he was merely one of the people involved, and arguably not even the most important one. This book sets the record straight, and it tells the story of how it was three Oxford scientists, Howard Florey, Ernst Chain, and Norman Heatley, who isolated penicillin and turned it into a life-saving drug. It's a remarkable story, very well told, about a scientific breakthrough conducted on a shoestring budget in the middle of the Second World War that has benefited all of humanity. Matthew, I think I can guess why you chose this book, but perhaps you could elaborate.
Well, actually, you've already given the three reasons. I think the first and most important is it's really genuinely the greatest story of sort of medical transformation, certainly of the last century, of the 20th century, and possibly even of all time. So it is just a fantastic story. But the two other reasons are, one is that I feel very personally linked to it, despite having never worked in the field or not knowing any of the people involved directly. I am Florey, who is the sort of protagonist of this story. I am his successor, but two, as head of the Dunn School. And the Dunn School, the department which I'm now head of, is where most of the action takes place. And therefore, I sort of feel a little bit like my role is to be the keeper of the eternal flame for the truth of the penicillin story. Because the third reason is that I think that the great thing about this book, as you said, is it sets the record straight. Because what we've all learned in school about the role of Alexander Fleming turns out really just to be the tip of the iceberg. And the Oxford element of the story is enormous. And therefore, it felt to me like this is just a great read.
And what was it then that Fleming actually did?
Well, that's what we all learn about in school. There are various exact versions of the story. But broadly speaking, the story, as we often learn it, is he came back from holiday to his lab at St. Mary's in London. And he saw an old petri dish where he had been growing some bacteria that he'd sort of left before he went on holiday. And he noticed it had got infected by a big moldy growth in the middle of the plate. And what he noticed was that around that mold, the bacteria that were already on the plate were now dead. And he made, so this was an observation, but what he made then was a very important and probably, you know, the key inventive leap, which was to realize, given that these bacteria were dead at some distance from the mold, then there was something that was coming out of the mold that was killing them. And so he had the idea that there must be something in this mold that was able to move across the dish that was killing the bacteria. And his goal for a couple of years was to see whether he could identify a substance that the mold was producing. Sadly, he didn't and failed. So he spent two or three years trying this quite hard, but he was pretty much a lone microbiologist working in a hospital in London, and he didn't really have the tools or the expertise to do it. And after about two or three years more of trying to study this substance, so he gave up. And so I think the point is that he did indeed make the observation and the inventive leap to understand that that meant that there was something in the penicillin mold. It was a penicillin mold that was growing that was killing bacteria. But he tried and failed and concluded that probably it wasn't, not just that he couldn't do it, but he concluded that this probably wasn't going to ever turn into anything useful.
Yes, and he did give a paper or two, didn't he?
Yes.
Which was not very well received, I seem to remember, at a talk. And nobody was terribly interested. And then he published a paper, and it wasn't until sort of 10 years later that was picked up by the people in Oxford who decided to look at it further, possibly because It was just at the beginning of the war, wasn't it, that happened?
Well, it was actually just before the war. I think one of the interesting themes is, yes, so when Fleming first started to give talks about this work back in the late 20s and early 30s, it became clear that he was a terrible communicator.
Yes.
He was inarticulate, he mumbled, he didn't express himself well, and people were just bored. And you and I have probably sat in scientific seminars, and however good the science is, if the speaker if it doesn't do a good job of communicating it, it can be quite difficult to pick up the sort of gist of it and why it might be important. And I think people simply didn't really notice.
And they probably got bored, which is the other thing that happens if it's not a good speaker. You simply turn off.
You start thinking about what's for lunch or your experiment that you've left the lab to come to this talk for. Yes, exactly. So he didn't do a very good job of that. But I think he has to be given credit for having tried. And I think, no one is arguing that he isn't a key figure in the penicillin story. It's just that there is a very clear element of him having tried, decided there was nothing there, and giving up. And then, as you said, there's a gap. There's a gap of almost sort of 8 years until the team in Oxford essentially they're looking for antibacterial, they want to work on antibacterial substances. They've already worked out that this would be an important thing. And they're trawling through the literature, and they didn't have the internet in those days. So this was literally going to libraries and finding old copies of journals and trying to figure out what was there. And one of them, Ernst Chain, discovered this paper from Fleming that had been published about 8 or 9 years previously. So I think this was in 1938 this was happening, and the original Fleming paper had been in 1929, and said, actually, you know what? This looks interesting. And I think now, 8 or 9 years later, with the expertise that we have, that Fleming didn't have, we should go back to this.
It also said something rather important. It said that penicillin wasn't toxic, because I think he had tried to isolate it, or Fleming had, and I believe he had injected it into a normal mouse and nothing had happened. Well, that might be because, of course, there wasn't enough penicillin there, but it was actually because it wasn't toxic. And because they saw that was one reason, I think, why they decided to work on that.
I think that was essential. What we need to remember is that at the time there were these still fairly recent drugs called the sulfonamides, which were synthetic molecules that had some antibacterial activity, but they were also pretty toxic. And the gap between the level that you could give to someone that might kill some bacteria but was toxic, the difference was fairly low. You had to treat people up until it was nearly poisoning them. And so there was a big understanding that there was a sort of two problems. One was things that would kill bacteria, and the other was things that would not be toxic to the patients.
So then we moved to Oxford and the Oxford team. You've mentioned two of them already. One is Professor Howard Florey, who was Australian. Another was Ernst Chain, a Jewish refugee whose family were actually murdered in the Holocaust, or some of them were. Completely different type of personality. And then there was the third one, the sort of unsung hero who nobody seems to have heard of, who was Norman Heatley, who was the sort of diffident English gentleman who everybody could work with. But they were extremely different, their personalities, weren't they? Do you think that Eric Lacks gives a good description of their different personalities and the way they interacted?
Well, I think one of the great things about this book is that Eric Lacks describes the personalities of the people and makes it clear that science is done by scientists. And science is not some sort of platonic ideal world in which everyone is always entirely rational and devoid of personality. And the three people, well, actually, if you include Fleming as well, you couldn't really find three or four people who are more different from each other and more likely to clash in various ways. And indeed, one of the themes that runs throughout the book is the various personality clashes at different stages between different either individuals or groups within those people. So as you said, you had Howard Florey, who was clearly a very bright young scientist, a relatively young professor who just moved to Oxford, and he was Australian, and no doubt in the sort of snobbish world of Oxford in the 1930s, the fact that he was a sort of colonial Australian didn't go down well, and I think he quite enjoyed his image of being a bit sort of rough and outbacky. It's not really his background at all, but I think he quite enjoyed that. You had Ernst Chain, the German Jewish refugee who had only been in the country for 2 or 3 years, who highly cultured, came from a highly cultured and academic and left-wing background in Germany. And then you had Norman Heatley, as you say, the sort of slightly the modest, gentle English gentleman who in many ways was the inventive genius that was responsible for the actual practical breakthroughs that led to penicillin.
Yes, they all had different roles, really, didn't they? Florey was the one who got the money to support everything and had some of the initial ideas about why they should work on this. Chain was the chemist who was focused on purifying the active ingredient, and Heatley was the man who had to culture the mould, and not just culture it and get lots of it, but also improve the amount of penicillin that the mould actually made. And so they were trying to grow the most potent mould, and they had lots of other things to do, didn't they? First, they had to discover which bacteria it actually affected, what its effect was on human cells, and then they had to go on and test it in mice and men. So they did each of these things in turn, and it was a long and difficult process because penicillin is quite hard to handle, isn't it?
I think the reason that Fleming had not succeeded in London those 10 years earlier was because, indeed, penicillin is a very volatile molecule that does not last long, and it's very hard, it's very unstable, it's hard to maintain it. And so actually just the practical experimental detail of how you grow the mold, how you take the juice out of the mold, how you then take this crude juice and try from the, purify from that the penicillin, it was extremely challenging.
And even also to test its potency. Heatley came up with a good idea for that, if I remember. And one of the things I think is completely fascinating is that you can actually go and see the equipment which he used, or some of it, certainly some of the bedpans in which they used to grow the juice. They can be found in the History of Science Museum in Oxford.
The History of Science Museum in Oxford and the Science Museum in London. I mean, this is now so much part of a sort of, you know, it's such a world story that the equipment and the sort of paraphernalia around this is distributed in major museums around the world now.
And Heatley had some extraordinary apparatus, didn't he? He seemed to be an incredibly ingenious inventor of the apparatus itself, putting in lots of bits of glassware and so on in order to make something which could purify the penicillin.
I wish we had more photographs. We have rather few of the actual equipment in situ at that time. But it really was. It was milk churns and old bathtubs and bits of rubber tubing and glass tubing that he'd made himself, and, you know, things he had discovered in the back of his shed. I mean, it really was a sort of Heath Robinson, like, you know, that children's game Mousetrap, where you build this great contraption where a ball has to roll through this extraordinary device. I mean, it was the most sort of weird-looking apparatus. But the point is, it worked. And it worked based on some very important scientific principles that they had worked out between them. And then Heatley's job was to sort of scale that up into an apparatus that could actually be used and eventually turned into something that was quite high throughput and could process thousands of litres of mould juice, they called it, a day.
So when they got some of this juice, and they had purified it partially. They never succeeded in purifying it fully, of course. They decided that the next thing to do was to inject it into mice. And so they did that, first of all, to see if it was toxic. And they also discovered that it passed through into the urine of the mouse. And that was a very important finding, I think, because it showed them that it remained active in the body of the animal. So it wasn't destroyed in any way. So then they had to test it on a streptococcus infection in mice. And that was quite an experiment, wasn't it?
Oh, that was really the iconic experiment. And since I now have the office that was Florey's office at the time, I sort of like to think that actually probably in the room that I spend much of my day in was where they sat up waiting to find out the results. Because what they did, I mean, as you say, it was an absolutely iconic experiment. They injected 8 mice with a lethal dose of bacteria, of streptococcal bacteria, and then they injected 4 of them with penicillin and 4 of them with a blank without penicillin in it. and they waited to see what happened. And over the course of a night, they did this sort of one afternoon, over the course of the night, the four mice that had not received the penicillin all died as predicted, and the four mice that had received the penicillin all survived. And, you know, that you could not get a sort of cleaner and more direct demonstration that this substance not only was not toxic to mice, but actually in an animal, because they'd already shown that it could work against the bacteria when you grew the bacteria in culture. But in an animal, you could actually cure a bacterial infection. And that really was the experiment that changed the world.
Yes, and it must have been incredibly exciting for them to see that. Can you imagine? I mean, I'm sure you've had times when suddenly something has happened that's made you enormously excited because you're the first person to have ever seen this. But to do something like that.
Oh, I mean, you know, it's
unbelievable.
It's what we all dream of, right? Mm. I mean, you know, as scientists, the buzz you get is when you find something that no one's found before. But, you know, normally that is on something of such a micro level that it's partly that no one's ever been to look before or cared about it. This was something where, I mean, although I think they didn't let themselves get carried away, and they certainly didn't talk about it publicly, I think that at some level they must have all understood after that one experiment that the chances were now suddenly that this rather sort of obscure line of work, which had not been easy to fund, and you know, there are a lot of people up to that point hadn't believed that this was going anywhere. And I think after that experiment, individually, even if they didn't talk about it, they must have realized this was probably, they were onto something huge.
But they did publish a paper, and there are two things that happened from that. First of all, the man from the MRC, the Medical Research Council, turned up saying, why had they not received as much credit as the Rockefeller Foundation
yes.
for funding their research? And the other person who turned up was Fleming, who comes back into the story, who wandered up to say he'd come to see what the Oxford group had done with my old penicillin.
Yeah, it's a really interesting, it's really hard to get to the bottom of how the sort of relationship and exactly how everyone saw it at the time. What we do know is that, yes, Fleming visited to have a look, and Florey and his team absolutely acknowledged the importance of what Fleming did all the way through. Later on, as we'll come to, the story gets a bit murkier in terms of when the real claims for credit started flying around. But there is no question that Fleming acknowledged the fact that at the time, Fleming was definitely acknowledging the fact that the Oxford team were the ones that had done the work that had led to the breakthrough. And in return, the Oxford team acknowledged the fact that Fleming had been the person that made the initial inventive discovery of the fact that the moulds did kill bacteria.
Yes, but of course, a mouse is not a man. And the next thing to do was to scale up and test it in humans. And that, of course, was difficult because they needed to grow such huge amounts of penicillin, and they needed containers to grow it in, because I think they'd been using old biscuit tins or something.
Yes.
And then I think it was Heatley went off to the potteries to get them to make things that looked like bedpans but out of pots. And hundreds of those turned up, in which they grew the mould, and they had six penicillin girls, I believe they were called, to do the actual culturing.
Well, there is an interesting aside about gender in science, and the fact that these people who were, they were technicians, they weren't sort of the main scientists, but they were very important in the whole process, and yet they only were known by the name the penicillin girls. There were six of them. We do know who they all were, but you know, they were the penicillin girls. And the other thing about gender in science I'd just point out is that Howard Florey's wife, Ethel, actually rapidly became the leader of the clinical studies of penicillin. And again, she is not a name that anyone really thinks about. So we can park that. Maybe that's not for today's discussion.
Maybe not for today, but I sympathise enormously.
I think it's an important issue. But yes, so after this extraordinary experiment with mice, which was done in May 1940, this was on the night before the Dunkirk evacuation started. So this was at a really critical period in the war, which of course explains partly why they were working with sort of biscuit tins and old bathtubs. It was because, you know, Britain at that stage was it was the Blitz. It was the, you know, the lowest point in the Second World War. Indeed, the name that we should say, the name that this rather weird name of the book, The Mould in Dr. Florey's Coat, refers to the fact that they had the idea that if they took the spores of the penicillin mould and literally rubbed the spores into their clothing, then if as was being anticipated at the time, the Germans invaded Britain and they all had to evacuate. They would be able to actually literally carry the spores of the mold if any of them got away to somewhere else where they could continue with the work, because they would have had to destroy all their work in the face of a German invasion.
Yes, and they had to keep going out and digging air raid shelters and doing fire duty. I mean, Oxford didn't get bombed in the war, but that wasn't to say that it might not have been. So, of course, they had to take precautions. But let's move on to the testing in humans, So they finally did get enough. And the first thing they did, of course, was to test it in somebody who was about to die to make sure that it wasn't toxic, which it didn't turn out to be. Of course, and then to test it in patients with septicemia. And I think this is one of the very interesting things. We don't expect to see people dying of sepsis these days. But in those days, they had a ward that was entirely dedicated to sepsis patients. So it wasn't very difficult to find somebody with septicemia. And one of the people they first tested it on was a guy called Albert Alexander, a policeman, who had an infection from a rose scratch on his face. I mean, he was extremely ill with loads of abscesses and on the way to dying, I believe. And then they gave him the penicillin. And within a day or two, he was feeling much better and things were getting better. And they were collecting his urine and re-extracting the penicillin from it. After a few days, he seemed so much better that they stopped, didn't they? And he was stable for a while, but then deteriorated again, and they just didn't have enough penicillin.
So that was the key point, that it was so hard to produce enough penicillin. Mm-hmm. And the reason they were re-extracting it from his urine, they were literally cycling it between the Radcliffe Infirmary on one side of Oxford to the Dunn School on the other side of Oxford, re-extracting it, is because they simply didn't have enough. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, Albert Alexander, this policeman, actually, it turns out almost certainly not to be true. The mythology is the scratch from the rose thorn. I had the great pleasure and honour just a few weeks ago of meeting his daughter. And it turns out that that isn't true, and that it was a wound that he had received while acting as an air raid warden. He'd gone down to Southampton and was acting as an air raid warden. But anyway, he had this sepsis. He was definitely at death's door. They treated him with penicillin. He got miraculously better in a way that no one had ever seen before for a sepsis patient. Sadly, the sort of end of the story was they simply didn't have enough. And as we all know, when you're given an antibiotic by your doctor, even now you're told to finish the course, and that's because you have to get rid of all the bacteria, not just down to a level where they're no longer causing symptoms. And they simply didn't have enough to finish the treatment, and he did die. Nevertheless, however sad a story that was individually, it was sufficient again to, you know, confirm what they had seen in the mice, which was the penicillin had this activity.
So then, of course, they obtained more penicillin and tested it on other patients. And they did indeed get people who survived.
Yes.
Of course, one of the problems was that they were initially testing it on patients who were at death's door. When they tested it on people who were not so seriously ill, then, of course, they did get better and remained well.
Yes, I mean, in a way, it's double-edged. Those people who were on death's door were the hardest ones to treat. But even of those, most of them recovered. Mm-hmm. And that was, you know, the whole sort of notion of a miracle drug and stuff grew out of those experiments. And if I remember rightly, I think 10 out of the first 12 patients they treated got better, and two mm-hmm. didn't. So, you know, already it was clear, even treating the very ill patients initially.
But then they had a problem, because it was clear to them that this was a miracle drug and how incredibly valuable it was going to be. But of course, they couldn't make very much, so they needed to interest drug companies. Of course, in the middle of the war, it was terribly difficult because drug companies in the UK, they were all dedicated to the war effort, or they were in the middle of an area where bombs were flying around. And they were unable to do so. They couldn't actually get anybody interested in making a large amount of this. What they needed was large fermenters. And then they spoke to the Medical Research Council. They also weren't interested. So then Florey decided to go to the Rockefeller Foundation, who'd in the USA, who had funded quite a bit of the work, to ask them for help in getting US companies involved. And I think Lax describes this incredible trip that they made to get to the United States. Yes, by flying boat, stopping off at the from Lisbon to the Azores to Bermuda. Extraordinary.
It's actually the scene in Casablanca, the Humphrey Bogart movie. Lisbon was the one exit place from Europe to a sort of safe-ish exit point from Europe to America. And so they had to get themselves down to Lisbon by sort of blacked out plane. And then they got on this incredibly grand Pan Am Clipper, which had sort of silver service and dining tables and things in the plane, and flew, as you say, via Azores and Bermuda to New York, to LaGuardia.
And then, of course, Florey had to convince people of the importance of penicillin. And it turns out, I mean, Heatley describes what a wonderful presenter he was, how brilliantly he spoke and how he managed to convince everybody that it was very important. But the drug companies were still not that keen on making it, were they? Until, I think, the chair of the US Medical Research and Development Committee said that the US government was actually interested in this. And then they started to work together. I think one of the problems was that the problem with a company, of course, is that you want to keep what you find to yourself, and sharing it with others was not so easy.
It was complicated. It was clearly going to be quite a hard problem to scale up the penicillin production. I think there was a lot of issue about who was going to make the profit, how could the company share it. Florey was well connected through the Rockefeller Foundation and other colleagues. And actually, the person who probably made the biggest difference was Vannevar Bush, who was the father of the first Bush president and therefore the grandfather of the second Bush president. And he was the chair of that science committee, the Congressional Science Committee, and it was him who sort of applied the pressure and eventually brought several drug companies together in a sort of shared deal that they would use their expertise in fermentation that they already had in various places and for various reasons to try and scale up the penicillin effort.
And then, of course, the US entered the war and penicillin was seen to be something really important, and everybody started to try to produce it and large amounts were made. And it's rather sad because Florey said that he would go to the States and share his knowledge with everybody. All he wanted in return was a kilo of penicillin. But when the US entered the war, there was no chance that he would get that. It was all kept by the US.
There's a huge amount in this book that we don't have time to talk about in great detail about the sort of politics of this. And indeed, there is a real irony in the fact that this work was done in the UK by the Oxford Group and by Fleming. And in the end, most of the production and the patents ended up in the US. Mm. Now, you could argue that in terms of the greater good to humanity, and particularly at a time of the Second World War, what mattered was the outcome, not who got the credit or the money. But still, it left a bitter taste.
Particularly because Cheyne wanted to patent it, and mainly to bring money into the Dunn School, not for himself, but for further research. And he said that if Florey didn't patent it, someone else would, which is, of course, exactly what happened. Or rather, the method of producing the penicillin was patented. But Florey thought this was rather odious, and the MRC felt the same. So this wasn't done.
Yeah, it was a very complicated story. It was one of many things, I think, that led to a breakdown of relations between Cheyne and Florey. Mm-hmm. And Cheyne was proved right that patenting it was eventually done. And in the end, Britain had to pay large amounts of money to US drug companies to use the penicillin that was discovered here.
And one of the things it was used for, which I think is a particularly fascinating story, was, of course, it was used in the war. And Florey went off to North Africa to oversee its use on wounded soldiers to discover whether it could be used effectively in the field, really, and how is the best way to use it. And what they found was that it was extremely effective against gonorrhea. And there were large numbers of soldiers who were incapacitated by gonorrhea. And although it was very effective on war wounds as well, the generals wanted to use it on gonorrhea, and Florey was not keen on that. He thought it should be used for
the heroes.
Exactly so. So they cabled Churchill, and Churchill came back with this wonderful answer. This valuable drug must in no account be wasted. It should be used to the best possible military advantage.
Which was assumed, has always been assumed to mean that it should be given to the soldiers with the STDs, because they were the ones that would be able to get back and fight. as opposed to the ones who had wounds that might, where the penicillin might save their lives, but they would not be contributing to the war effort.
And that's indeed what happened. And of course, they were instrumental in the Italian campaign, I believe, some of those soldiers.
Yeah, although, I mean, at some point we'll say it, but let's say it now. One of the most extraordinary things about this story is the speed at which it all happened. So remember, it was 1938 when we believe Cheyn goes to Flory and says, I found this paper and I think we should start looking at it. Before the end of the Second World War, there was enough penicillin to treat all the soldiers across the whole, all the Allied soldiers across the whole world. The scale up was absolutely extraordinary. So it probably was actually a relatively short time window when they were giving it to the soldiers with the STDs over the patients who with war wounds, because soon they had enough for everyone.
Yes, but the speed, as you say, was remarkable, but actually it's very similar, in fact, to what's happened with the COVID vaccinations recently.
I think that's a really interesting example, because actually if you'd said this before COVID, the conversation would have gone, well, compare it with today, when a new drug takes at least 20 years to develop. And it is true that drugs do take 20 years to develop in general, but as you exactly point out, that, you know, with COVID, we prove that when we really, really need to, we still can do it very fast.
So how did Fleming come to get the credit? We should come back to that.
It's one of the most interesting parts of the story, and I think that Eric Lax writes about it beautifully, because it's a sort of, it's a fairly early example of a sort of media campaign, a really concerted media campaign. What we have to remember is in those days, this was before the National Health Service, and so hospitals were effectively private institutions. St. Mary's, the hospital that he was a part of, didn't have much money, and they were desperately trying to raise money. So his boss, I think he was the chairman of the board of directors or trustees of St. Mary's, essentially started to spin, he was a grand man, and he was very well connected, and he managed to spin the story to the London media, to the press, that this was entirely done by Fleming. Now, it gets murky because Fleming clearly at some points pointed out that this was a bit unfair and that Oxford were very instrumental in it at the very least. But equally, it became clear that Fleming did rather enjoy the credit and the attention he was getting. And at the same time, Flory in Oxford, being a very different character, and I think rather damagingly, he was sort of too high and mighty and pompous to engage with the media at all.
Well, I don't think it was quite like that, if I may say so. I mean, from the way I recall it, or the way that Eric Lax tells it, is that Fleming had a friend who was seriously ill in St. Mary's and needed some penicillin, and he asked Flory for it, and Flory came, showed him how to administer it, and that was continued then by Fleming, and this man, Lambert, recovered. And Fleming was not averse to talking about this. And then the person you're talking, Almroth Wright, I believe, wrote to the Times newspapers talking about this wonderful recovery, which nobody had really talked about. It's used in people before. And of course, they flocked to see Fleming because it was all about how Fleming did it. And you're right, he did discuss it. He did give credit at that time to the Oxford team. But then they all rushed to Oxford and Flory turned them away. And I think Flory turned them away because he was afraid that if this got out into the press, hundreds of thousands of people would hope that they too could get penicillin to cure themselves or their loved ones. And there just wasn't the penicillin available at the time.
Yes, I think that your description is better than mine and more nuanced. I mean, I think it's certainly true that one patient that Fleming treated with penicillin that he had been come up to Oxford to get and had been told by Flory how to do it, that was blown out of all proportion by the sort of media spin. And secondly, when Flory's lack of interest in talking to the media. I'm sure you're right that it was partly that concern that he would be getting hopes up in a way that couldn't be fulfilled. However, I mean, my read of it is that he was also, you know, he was very averse to the idea of sort of personal publicity for him or for Oxford. And that, in the end, was probably rather damaging.
Extremely. And I think another part of the problem was that the mould, the penicillin mould, was known as penicillin, but the drug was also known as penicillin. So it's really easy to get them confused. Perhaps if the drug had been called something different, then it would have been, I discovered the penicillin mould, yes, and the Oxford team discovered this drug.
That's a very interesting idea. Yeah, I hadn't thought about that, but you're right. That might have made a difference.
So then, of course, we come to the Nobel Prize, which actually was awarded only in 1945, which is an incredibly short time between a discovery and the Nobel Prize. And there were rumours that, I don't know where they came from, but that Fleming was going to get the Nobel Prize for the discovery of penicillin. And fortunately, various friends and scientists who knew the whole story wrote to the people at Stockholm and said, I think you should also consider various other people who are involved. And in the event, the prize went to Florey, Fleming and Chain, but since you can only have it for three people, unfortunately Heatley got left out, and he played such an important role in the discovery of the drug itself. I've always thought that was really rather unfair.
Yes, it was. I mean, as you say, there is a strict, I mean, it's well known and it's caused angst down the years. There's a strict rule that the Nobel Prize can only ever be given to three people. So when you have inventions or discoveries that involve more than three people, there is a great issue about how do you apportion credit. So that's one thing to say. I think the three of them, Chain, Florey and Fleming, shared it equally. And I'd say that sort of history probably suggests that was the right solution, that they all jointly deserved it. Heatley was clearly, I used a term earlier, the inventive genius, and I think that is correct. I think that experimentally, many of the advances that were required were made by Heatley. He was not at any point the person who led the operation. So the prize went to probably the three people who were the leaders of the operation. But Heatley is probably the person without whom the penicillin discovery would have at the very least been much delayed.
There's a wonderful quote, isn't there, from Henry Harris. Without Fleming, no Chain or Florey. Without Chain, no Florey. Without Florey, no Heatley. Without Heatley,
no penicillin. Yes, and I think that's right. And the only thing I would say now, we are speaking in 2023, is that Heatley is no longer forgotten. He is not part of the Nobel. He is not part of the sort of perhaps global legend of penicillin. But he is actually now well recognised in the way that we're discussing as being the person who was so instrumental. And I think that is important.
But I think what's really important is this book, because that it may be the case that Heatley and indeed Florey and Chain are known about on the streets of Oxford. But I think in most of the world, most people would say that penicillin was discovered by Fleming. And they still don't know the rest of this incredible story.
Yes. We've only scratched the surface of the sort of media campaign that went from about 1943 onwards to around the Fleming mythology. And he became one of the most famous people in the world. He actually died rather young, so he died in 1955. But in those sort of 10 years subsequent to the Nobel Prize, he was probably, you know, up there with the most famous people in the world. And Florey and Chain and Heatley never made it to that level at all.
No. But hopefully this conversation and this book will do something to remedy that. I think that's probably all we have time for today. So my thanks to Professor Matthew Freeman, head of the Dunn School of Pathology at the University of Oxford. The book we've been discussing is The Mould in Dr. Florey's Coat by Eric Lax, which was published in paperback by Abacus in 2005. You can catch up with more suggestions for a good science read on our podcasts, which can be found on the University of Oxford's website or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening. Thank you.